Today is Friday, January 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Poland expresses fears that Europe is closer to war than it has been at any time in the last 30 years.
It seems that the risk of war in the OSCE area is now greater than ever before in the last 30 years.
Russia warns it could deploy troops to Cuba and Venezuela if tensions with the United States mount.
Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov told Russian media that he couldn't exclude the possibility of Russian military deployment in Cuba and Venezuela.
And President Joe Biden plans to double to 1 billion the rapid at-home COVID-19 tests to be distributed free to Americans. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Polish Foreign Minister Zbigniew Rau warned on Thursday that Europe is closer to war than it has been at any time in the last 30 years. He made his comments at the launch of his country's year-long chairmanship of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Without naming Russia in his address to envoys from the 57 members of the group, Rau mentioned tensions in Ukraine, Georgia, Armenia, and Moldova, all countries with active or frozen conflicts in which Moscow is allegedly to be a party. Polish Foreign Minister Zbigniew Rau.
It seems that the risk of war in the OSCE area is now greater than ever before in the last 30 years. In this vein, we should focus on a peaceful resolution of the conflict in and around Ukraine in compliance with the Minsk agreements and in full respect of the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and unity of Ukraine within its internationally recognized borders. The latest developments in Kazakhstan gave us serious reasons for concerns.
That's Polish Foreign Minister Zbigniew Rau. As the United States and Russia met for talks in Geneva this week, the future security of Europe was at stake. But the European Union was not present. And bloc officials have voiced growing frustration, as Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Russia has massed over 100,000 troops close to the border with Ukraine. Meanwhile, Moscow complains of a NATO military build-up in Eastern Europe and has warned of the dangers of confrontation. With tensions building, Washington and Moscow met for talks in Geneva this week, but the European Union was excluded to its clear frustration. Josep Borrell is the European Union High Representative for Foreign Affairs.
On this dialogue, there are not two actors alone. It's not just US and Russia. If we want to talk about security in Europe, the Europeans have to be part of the table.
But the EU is late to that table, says analyst Liana Fix, a resident fellow at the German Marshall Fund in Washington, D.C.
The problem here is that the European Union has not been involved formally in talks in 2014 when the Ukraine crisis started. Back then we had Germany and France in the Normandy format and no official EU representative within the European Union. The question is who is more powerful, the member states or the EU as an institution itself. And on the other hand, in Moscow, the EU is not taken seriously.
France is leading a European push for what it calls greater strategic sovereignty, driven by concerns over America's commitment to NATO. Paris says Russia's President Vladimir Putin is deliberately trying to bypass the EU. Jean-Yves Le Drian is the French Foreign Minister.
He has no consideration for the European Union, and he is totally determined to try to put dents in European unity, which is solidifying.
Moscow also aims to undermine the transatlantic alliance, argues analyst Petro Berkovsky, a senior fellow at the Democratic Initiatives Foundation in Kiev.
Russia uses these talks in order to destroy trust between the United States and European partners, and tries to demonstrate that the United States are ready to discuss its security in Europe and discuss its policy in Europe behind the European partners.
Without its own military force, the European Union as an institution may not be taken seriously by Moscow, but it does have a key role to play, says analyst Liana Fix.
When the European Union and the United States now think about economic sanctions towards Russia in case of an intervention, of an invasion of Ukraine, then it is the European Union that will have to deliver an economic sanctions package and has to deliver the agreement of all member states.
Meanwhile, following talks between NATO and Russian officials Wednesday, the United States said transatlantic allies were united. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman led the U.S. delegation.
I think one of the things that Russia has done, which it probably did not expect, it has brought all of Europe, NATO and non-NATO allies alike, together to share the same set of principles, the same ambition, the same hopes, and the same commitment to diplomacy.
21 European Union member states are also members of NATO. And despite the frustration, analysts say the EU recognises that the alliance remains the bedrock of its own security. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Russia has warned it could deploy troops to Cuba and Venezuela if tensions with the United States mount. Associated Press correspondent Karin Chamas reports.
Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov told Russian media that he couldn't exclude the possibility of Russian military deployment in Cuba and Venezuela. Ryabkov led the Russian delegation in recent negotiations in Geneva. The talks failed to find a solution to Moscow's security demands amid a build-up of Russian troops near Ukraine. Ryabkov said that Russian President Vladimir Putin had warned military technical measures would be taken if the U.S. increased pressure on Russia. I'm Karen Chamas.
A Russian-led military bloc began pulling its troops out of Kazakhstan on Thursday. This after a week-long deployment during the worst bout of unrest in the Central Asia nation's post-Soviet history. Olivia Chan of Reuters reports.
A Russian-led military bloc began pulling its troops out of Kazakhstan on Thursday, marked by this withdrawal ceremony. It comes after a week-long deployment amid an explosion of unrest in the Central Asian nation. Authorities claim the country's former security chief was suspected of attempting a coup. Russia said the withdrawal of the troops would be completed on January 19th, earlier than previously announced. The deployment had been criticized by Western leaders, alarmed by a build-up in Russian troops near Ukraine. Moscow has denied allegations it plans to invade, but said security talks this week had hit a dead end and threatened unspecified consequences. It was unclear how many troops out of about 2,500 sent were leaving immediately. Kazakh President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev asked for assistance from the Collective Security Treaty Organization, or CSTO, last week, after what started as a peaceful protest, triggered by a sharp increase in car fuel prices, turned violent in many big cities. The Kazakh authorities announced the completion of what they called an anti-terrorist operation in most of the country on Wednesday, although they have yet to declare its biggest city, Almaty, fully secure. The authorities have detained almost 10,000 people over the arrest, saying some of the protesters were foreigners trained by Islamist militants. Tokayev has said this justifies CSTO involvement. Some Kazakhs have echoed a comment by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken that Kazakhstan might have a hard time getting rid of Russian troops after letting them in.
The Biden administration on Wednesday imposed its first sanctions over North Korea's weapons program following a series of North Korean missile launches, including two since last week. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
The White House slapped down the first Biden-era sanctions over North Korea's weapons program on Wednesday. That move came as North Korean state media released more images of the country's recent missile launches. KRT showed photos of Kim Jong-un watching this week's missile test, the first one he's officially attended in nearly 2 years. The new U.S. sanctions target six North Koreans, one Russian, and a Russian firm, accusing them of procuring goods from Russia and China for Pyongyang's weapons program. The U.S. is putting pressure on the U.N. Security Council to take similar action. Washington wants five of those individuals to also be subject to a UN travel ban and asset freezes. Any measure would, however, need consensus agreement by the body's 15-member North Korea Sanctions Committee. Since Biden took office in January last year, he has sought unsuccessfully to engage Pyongyang in dialogue to persuade it to give up its nuclear bombs and missiles. A spokesman for the State Department said the U.S. remained committed to pursuing diplomacy with North Korea. Pyongyang has been accused of carrying out six ballistic missile launches since September, each of which violated UN Security Council resolutions.
That's Laura Bradley Watson of Reuters. President Joe Biden says the government plans to double to 1 billion the rapid at-home COVID-19 tests to be distributed free to Americans. Speaking at the White House on Thursday, Biden says his administration will also make the most protective N95 masks available for no charge. With Omicron infections about to reach their peak in the U.S., demands for COVID-19 tests have hit the roof. But are they what they are cracked out to be? VOA's Veronica Banderas Iglesias investigates.
Jordan Irby and his partner Julia Weil visit COVID-19 testing sites often.
We get tested so that we can see our friends without being concerned that we're spreading COVID.
They'd rather have someone who's trained take samples for a lab instead of relying on at-home tests. The Weil has used self-tests before visiting elderly relatives.
The process itself was pretty easy, but I wasn't confident about what the results said.
Her instinct was right. In 2020, researchers found that in people with COVID symptoms, the antigen tests were less accurate than the PCR tests, which can take a lab 48 hours to process. Alexandra Bryson is the Associate Director of Clinical Microbiology at the Virginia Commonwealth University Health System.
We directly compared the Binax Now antigen test to the gold standard PCR test. The antigen test missed detecting 20% of all COVID-19 cases.
There's no conclusive data yet on how well rapid antigen tests work on the Omicron variant. But people can take steps to be more confident in the results. As is, they catch about 4 in 5 positive cases. Testing too early in the infection is discouraged, says Dr. Robert Bollinger, a professor of infectious diseases at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.
If you're testing while you're symptomatic and you have a bad cold symptoms and you have a lot of virus in your system, you're more likely to be accurate in that situation. We do often recommend multiple rapid tests, so not just one test, but you do your antigen test today, maybe test it again in 24 or 36 hours.
Dr. Peter Chen Hung, a professor of medicine in California, says pay close attention to the swabbing technique when testing at home.
Depending on the platform, you swab at least 5 to 10 times on each side, and then you put it in the reagent, and then you just basically have to time it. Not look too soon because it may be falsely negative, and not look too late because they may be unstable chemicals.
President Joe Biden's administration has promised 500 million COVID test kits for American households soon. And local governments are rushing to open new testing sites. They encourage patients to report positives to their healthcare providers. But they also emphasize testing is only one part of the answer to containing the virus. Hannah Winant is the spokeswoman of the Arlington County Department of Public Safety, Communications, and Emergency Management.
We still caution our residents and people around the world to follow steps to prevent the spread of COVID-19, regardless of whether or not they have a negative test. That's maintaining social distancing, wearing a mask when indoors with people outside of your immediate household, and most importantly, to get vaccinated.
Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
The World Health Organization reports the surge of the fast-spreading Omicron variant in Africa appears to have peaked and is flattening in most African countries. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
This is a bit of good news for a continent that has been devastated by the COVID-19 pandemic, which is entering its third year. As of now, the World Health Organization reports more than 10 million people in Africa have been infected with coronavirus, and more than 230,000 have died. The UN Health Agency reports Africa appears to be emerging from its fourth pandemic wave, driven primarily by the Omicron variant, which quickly overtook the Delta variant to become the dominant strain. After a six-week surge, WHO says Omicron has recorded its first drop in cases. If this trend continues, WHO says it will mark the shortest-lived surge so far on the continent. Abdou Salam Gueye is Director of Emergency Preparedness and Response in WHO's Regional Office for Africa. He says it is premature to let down one's guard, as the latest data was collected during the holiday period, when numbers tend to be underreported.
Over the past week, cases plateaued compared with the week before, dropped by a little bit, 0.2%. Infection have also declined in three of Africa's five sub-regions. Only North and West Africa are currently witnessing an increase in cases.
Anita Graham is in the Department of Pulmonology, University of Witwatersrand, South Africa. She says the Omicron variant has accounted for 95% of all infections during the region's huge fourth pandemic wave. However, she says there have been far fewer severe cases, hospitalizations, and deaths than from the more virulent Delta strain.
However, we are still seeing very serious infections and admissions in patients who are unvaccinated, and also in patients who have comorbidity, and this includes the elderly population. Our vaccination remains the best, most effective way of protecting ourselves and our patients from severe disease, hospitalization, and death.
Unfortunately, WHO officials note just 10% of Africa's population of 1.2 billion is fully vaccinated, compared to 50% of the wider world's population. They say the coming months will be critical in Africa's efforts to improve vaccination rates. They say Africa has the know-how and the tools to tip the balance against the pandemic if it is given the supplies and means to roll out these life-saving vaccines. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Norway takes over the rotating presidency of the Security Council in January. Mona Juul, Norway's ambassador to the United Nations, says that Norway has decided to elevate the open debate on the Middle East situation to a ministerial level on January 19th. Norway believes that Israeli-Palestinian conflict deserves more attention after 30 years of the Madrid Peace Conference. Ori Ner is a spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now, an organization that works to promote Israeli-Palestinian reconciliation. Reporter Angie Omar asked him if the renewed focus on the Middle East will help revive the peace process.
Well, first of all, I'll say I agree with Norway, and I think its approach is correct. Whether it will revive the peace process, probably not. But at the very least, which I think is still an important thing, it could revive the international interest in Israeli-Palestinian peace and in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And I hope that at the very least it will cause the Biden administration to rethink its attitude, its policy of benign neglect regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and efforts to resolve it. You know, Norway has played a very important role in the beginning of Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations, the process that's known as the Oslo process, and still has quite a bit of leadership, I would say, in this realm of Israeli-Palestinian relations. However, on the international arena, there's only one effective leader, only one player that can really push and play the role of a broker between the parties, between Israelis and Palestinians, and that's the United States. And unfortunately, it seems like the Biden administration at the moment is not interested in playing that role of a broker.
The U.S. administration announced that it is examining the possibility of reopening the offices of the Palestine Liberation Organization, and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas resumed security cooperation with Israel. Would such moves pave the way for resuming some sort of negotiations?
Such moves would pave the way to greater trust. I don't think that they will pave the way to negotiations per se. That still seems pretty far on the horizon. But it's still important to rebuild the trust between the Palestinians and the United States, between Israel and the Palestinians, There are three main players when it comes to Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations and the future of peace between them. And that's obviously Israel, the Israeli government, the Palestinian government or the PLO, and the United States. And so if the U.S. is taking measures to rebuild trust with the Palestinians, if the Palestinians are taking measures to rebuild trust with Israelis and vice versa, you have a more solid infrastructure or foundation over which you can rebuild the negotiations, the peace process in the future. At the moment, it doesn't seem like it's in the card, but in the future, I think it will be.
That's Ori Nahr, a spokesman for the group Americans for Peace Now, speaking with reporter Angie Omar. In other news, a federal grand jury in the District of Columbia returned an indictment Wednesday, which was unsealed Thursday, charging 11 defendants with seditious conspiracy and other charges for crimes related to the breach of the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th. The rampage disrupted a joint session of the U.S. Congress that was in process of ascertaining and counting the electoral votes related to the presidential election. According to court documents, two men are being charged for the first time in connection with events leading up to and including January 6th. The two who were arrested Thursday morning are Elmer Stewart Rhodes III, 56, of Granbury, Texas, who is the founder and leader of the Oath Keepers, and Edward Vallejo, 63, of Phoenix, Arizona. Rhodes was arrested in Little Elm, Texas, and Vallejo in Phoenix. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Burkina Faso's military prosecutor this week said authorities have arrested 8 soldiers for what local media reported was a plot to overthrow the state. Burkina Faso has been rattled by increasingly deadly Islamic militants' attacks and widespread protests over insecurity. Analysts warn the military may be unhappy with the government and its efforts to halt the attacks. Henry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou.
Burkina Faso's government has yet to confirm or deny local media reports that the 8 troops arrested this week were in fact planning a coup. The military prosecutor's office on Tuesday issued a statement that said the troops were arrested for plotting to destabilize the country and were under investigation. It gave no further details. Within minutes of the statement, local media began speculating that an attempt to overthrow the government had been foiled. Siaka Koulibaly is an analyst with the Centre for Public Policy Monitoring by Citizens in Burkina Faso. What information we have suggests there is some probability that this was an attempted coup, he says. Do we know that for certain, asks Koulibaly? And do we know the attempt was really likely to succeed? Media reports named Lieutenant Colonel Emmanuel Zongrana with 7 other soldiers as being taken into custody. President Roch Kabore in December relieved Lieutenant Colonel Zongrana of his post after an attack on a military base in northern Burkina Faso left at least 49 troops dead. An increasing number of attacks on troops and civilians have been blamed on terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda. Koulibaly says Kabore's recent sacking of military leaders could have sparked fighting within the military. He says there may very well be some score settling going on between the leaders of the different units. He says we should be cautious while waiting for the investigations to give much more convincing results. During November protests against the government and insecurity, the internet was shut down for 8 days. As the troops were arrested this week, mobile internet services were disrupted. Andrew Leibovich is an analyst with the Berlin-headquartered European Council on Foreign Relations.
There's been persistent unrest and unhappiness within the ranks of Burkina Faso's armed forces as the security situation's got worse, and amid feeling that the government is not doing enough or isn't pursuing the right strategy in fighting terrorism. From the government side, there is likely some concern given the coups in Mali and in Guinea especially about unrest among soldiers in more elite units.
But analysts warn that a military takeover would only further damage Burkina Faso's security and stability. Michael Shirkin is Director of Global Programs at 14N Strategies, a Senegal and US-based consultancy.
A coup d'etat in Burkina Faso would be absolutely disastrous for Burkina Faso and also for the region. It would undermine Burkina Faso's government and make it actually less capable of dealing with the insurgency than those who support the coup think it would. Burkina Faso's real strength, its asset, is the vibrancy of its democracy. Anything that undermines that asset, I think, is very short-sighted.
Burkina Faso's last attempted coup was in 2015 by supporters of former President Blaise Compaoré, just a month before the country's first democratic elections. A popular uprising overthrew Compaoré's 27-year rule in 2014, and he fled into exile in Ivory Coast. The elections were held in November, electing Roch Kabore as president. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
A report by Human Rights Watch says the situation in Cameroon worsened through 2021. The group's senior Central Africa researcher, Ilaria Allegrozzi, spoke with reporter Ricky Shryock about the forced school closures in some regions since 2017, as well as the other issues in the country.
Separatist groups have enforced a perverse boycott of school. They have killed, beaten, abducted, threatened, terrorized hundreds of students and teachers in the Anglophone regions. They have harassed and intimidated families into keeping their children out of school. Currently, according to the United Nations, some 700,000 students are out of school. So this is the very first serious consequence of attacks on education. Attacks on schools, students, teachers have had also an impact on the overall development of the communities, on the economy. Let's also not forget the psychological and emotional consequences of these attacks. Teachers, students who spoke to us, they said they have been traumatized after experiencing attacks or kidnappings or violence, assaults. They said they have struggled with depression, anxiety, fear, troubles in sleeping, nightmares, and other different emotional difficulties.
Given all of these issues facing Cameroonians, separatist violence, education boycotts, Boko Haram attacks, how important is the role of the press in Cameroon, and how is the role of that press stifled by the Cameroonian government at times? Because according to your report, there is continued restriction of freedom of expression.
Since the crisis started in the Anglophone regions in late 2016, for example, authorities have systematically tried to control the information flow and to hinder access to the Anglophone regions to independent media, independent national and international journalists. And few journalists have been able to visit the Anglophone regions since 2017, for example. Those who did were either embedded with the Cameroonian army or they traveled undercover.
Another human rights issue cited in your report that continues in Cameroon is the state-sanctioned persecution of the LGBT community. According to your report, it did intensify recently. Can you explain how it has intensified? What difficulties people who are in this community face living in Cameroon?
In the past year, there has been a concerning escalation in abuses, attacks, and arrests against LGBTI people in Cameroon. In our report, we highlight how security forces have beaten, threatened, verbally assaulted people arrested on homosexuality charges, including children. Throughout the year, we have interviewed LGBTI people who have been arrested and who provided shocking, chilling accounts about what they went through in detention. They didn't only report on physical assault, violence by the police, but also on the highly discriminatory language used against them. Police, for example, call them devils, monsters. They threaten them with death.
That's Human Rights Watch senior Central Africa researcher Ilaria Allegrozzi speaking with reporter Ricky Shryock from Italy. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Okoye in Washington. wishing you a great weekend.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.